Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So I'm here with David Duncan in an absolutely stunning structure that this is the first time I walked into this iteration of the winery. I was here many years ago, and David is one of those people that I've admired from afar for quite a few years. He's a vintner, an entrepreneur, a business person extraordinaire, a musician, a husband, a father, community leader, youth leader. There's just too, I'm sure I'm forgetting something. There's a lot of things about him. So we'll just start our conversation because there's so many questions that I have. But I would like to start with your childhood, and I know you grew up in Colorado. What was that like, and what was it like growing up with such an extraordinary dad? I met your late father because I used to be on your mailing list, believe it or not. And I know he was a very special person. So what was that like?
Well, glad to be here with you.
Thank you.
Start
Thank
you. There. So I did grow up in Colorado. My dad was quite an interesting entrepreneur, and he moved from Illinois, where he grew up, to Durango, Colorado in 1958. Mm-hmm. I like to say they were still riding horses and carrying guns in the street in those days, because it was a real cowboy town and a very small town, and was pursuing some interest in the oil and gas business, but then also got in the ski business and was the founder of Purgatory Ski Resort.
Okay.
And so, which is still in existence, although we are not involved at all anymore. But that is kind of pertinent to our story because I think to the Silver Oak story, because I think what happened was when he moved to Durango, he met a Forest Service agent who had an idea to start the ski area and knew where to do it. And mm-hmm. Dad said, well, I'll back you and we can be partners on starting the ski area. So just a few years later, he came out to California and met Justin Meyer. We might come back to some of the story, but met Justin Meyer, who was the winemaker who had an idea about how he wanted to make wine and said, I want to start a winery. And Dad said, well, I just did this with a ski area. I know how to do that with, and so it's kind of a corollary to the founding of Purgatory and the founding of Silver Oak sometimes in my mind. And my dad was a wonderful, great father, and I'm the baby of the family, so I had 4 years living at home without my brothers, basically. So I was a mixture of the little kid and then sort of an only child in high school. We moved to Denver from Durango when I was very young, so I went to grade school at a public school in Denver, and then went to a college prep school kind of thing in Denver. And we spent a lot of time coming out to California.
Yeah.
Silver Oak was, very much in the early days. And one of my favorite memories was I was probably 6 years old, 7 years old, and may have been, one of the first trips. I don't even remember if Silver Oak had been started, but that we were, for some reason, I was with my dad. I don't even remember why, but we were driving across the Golden Gate Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that old song called The Streak. It's a really funny song that's still around where the guy's going, turn your eyes, Hazel, and you're, or Mabel, or whatever her name is. And I just remember laughing so hard with my father and thinking that was like one of the coolest moments of my life. And I was like 6 or 7 years old at the time.
So
it was kind of a fun thing that I always tied to the Golden Gate Bridge and to California. So,
it's amazing how we remember things from childhood like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then my dad and I both enjoyed duck hunting and goose hunting. So we spent a lot of time waterfowling,
okay.
A lot of time skiing, a lot of time pursuing all the great things in Colorado. And so, it was a good, it's a good thing. The other thing that my father and I shared, since you started there with my dad, was we had the same birthday.
Really?
Yeah. And so I was born on his birthday. My mom always took credit said she drank castor oil to make sure that that would happen. And
apparently it works.
So we shared the same birthday, and unfortunately then he passed away 2 weeks before my 50th and what would have been his 85th. Wow. So that was a tough one. But yeah. I never felt like I was under his shadow, and growing up around a family business, and especially with an entrepreneurial family where there's different things to do for everybody, he would always say, pursue what you want to do and do what you're passionate about. And there was never a lot of pressure to, you have to do this or that, or you can't go enter this part of the family business or something else. And so he was always very open to, us pursuing what we wanted to do from our hearts, more than from our heads, which is a neat thing.
It is an extraordinary thing. I believe that we're all from childhood, and the fact that you come from a family that already had a prominent business presence, there's inherently, in most cases, would have been pressure to take over.
Yeah.
And the fact that your dad was such a gracious soul, even in a very intimate relational sense with his own children, that he wasn't pressuring them in any sense and wanting them to become who they wanted to become, I think that's very instructive. And I find it also really interesting that he was such an avid outdoorsman, that you just loved bonding with nature back then. And I'm sure that's still the case, right?
Yeah, I just got back from yesterday from Canada skiing. That's why I have this, I think I frostbit my nose.
So, I can't see that.
I still absolutely love being, in the outdoors. And
is it like one of your passions? I know we'll talk about others, but what is it like for you to just, I would imagine it's relaxing, it's nurturing in some ways.
Oh, absolutely. And I look for, and that's one of the beautiful things about living in the Napa Valley is, yeah, there's so many great opportunities for hiking and mountain biking and, or road cycling or, whatever, to be outside and to be in this beautiful place. And that's very, very filling for everything that you need, to take a break.
We forget because we associate it so strongly with wine, but it's actually an extraordinary, natural preserve, if you will.
And I don't do a lot of wine tasting, so not at other wineries, so I don't, that's not how I recreate here.
No, it's a good reminder that there's a lot of sides to the valley.
For sure.
So where did you go to school, and how was that?
So after high school, I went to Notre Dame, mm-hmm, undergrad.
Very prominent establishment.
And my daughter's actually going to be going there next year, so I'm very excited about that.
Very cool.
She'll be fourth generation. So, and I had a hard time in South Bend, Indiana. God bless the Irish. But just living there, moving there from Colorado, just talking about being an outdoorsman and then you go to South Bend, it's different. But then ended up spending a semester abroad in London and really loved that. I met my wife in London, who we were both on the same program and met there, and ended up coming back. So that was a really good experience. I was an English major because I really thought I was going to go to law school, and I didn't really want to be an attorney, but I wanted that experience. And then and as my kids would say, I wasn't qualified to do anything else except for study English, but I kind of had this idea that if I could read and write, I could do anything. Mm-hmm. And so it was, it served me really well. After I graduated from college, I moved back to Denver, and my wife was at the University of Colorado, mm-hmm, doing internal medicine or pursuing her becoming a physician. So she did her finished medical school at CU and then did her residency in internal medicine, and I ended up going to DU, the University of Denver, and got my MBA. And again, that English degree served me really well because you have to write a lot of papers when you're getting your MBA, especially in those days. It wasn't, mm-hmm, this was before there was executive MBA or online or anything like that. This was go to class at night because I was also working. And so I ended up pursuing that, and I really liked it. And so I ended up getting a major in finance, which required taking some extra classes. And then I had to do, they didn't really call it a thesis, but I had to do a final project. And that final project I did on Silver Oak. So I spent a quarter, a academic quarter at the University of Denver with a mentor, writing a business plan and creating a financial model and all that kind of thing for Silver Oak, and that was the topic that I picked. And so that was a direct line into me ending up, you know, moving out here and taking over running the winery. So
Silver Oak was founded by passion but also practicality. Obviously, it's a cult brand and has been that way from the inception. It's quite an outlier in many respects. I use it in my mind, and you know, when I speak to other people about a shining example of what for what it looks to me a perfect business is, Silver Oak leaps to mind first.
Well,
so,
thank you.
Absolutely, I want to really kind of delve into fleshing out the inception of the brand and conversely the role that you played in it, because it's such a powerful entity.
Yeah, so we first of all, again, I appreciate what you just said, and we work incredibly hard to try and achieve that, make that happen. But, but you know, we started in 1972, was our first vintage in the old dairy barn that was on the site here where we are now, that is the building that burned down in 2006. We'll get to that. And, you know, we made just over 1,000 cases our first vintage. And so very small, you know, I would say typical. My father didn't come to the wine business as, you know, a Francophile Bordeaux lover who had been drinking 62 Petrus and, you know, da 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 da. He wasn't like that at all. He drank Scotch in those days. And he really came to it as from a business perspective and loved land, loved the idea of growing things. You know, we ended up in the ranching business, and of course we're in the ski business at the time we started Silver Oak, and so, you know, this was kind of a natural extension for him, and really came to Napa and Sonoma County as a grape grower. That was his idea. That's what he wanted to do, was to grow grapes. And then when he met Justin Meyer, had the idea to, you know, to make the style of Cabernet that we still continue to make today. And so Justin was a very powerful, joyful and yet serious man who brought, you know, who could very clearly articulate his vision to Ray. And so, you know, they shook hands and became 50-50 partners in Silver Oak, and that, you know, that was how it started. So, you know, I think a couple of milestones that then happened. So one of the things to understand, your listeners can't see my hands, but I always count on my fingers, that we made the 72, the 73, the 74, and the 75, and we were in the process of the 76 vintage when we started selling the 72. So Dad, from an entrepreneurial standpoint, you know, I think that was one of the most interesting things that my dad did. It would be like building the ski area and not having it snow for 5 years, you know, or so. So, you know, which happened in the 80s, but that's a different story. But, you know, so Dad made this commitment to the brand and the idea of Silver Oak and what and Justin's winemaking without knowing what the consumer reaction would be at all. And so by the time we started releasing the wine, you know, we started very small, but we had sort of this immediate enjoyment of the wine. And I believe it was the 1974 vintage that won the California Gold Medal at the California State Fair, which at the time was like getting a 100-point score, because there was this was pre-Parker and everything, or maybe Parker was just starting, Wine Spectator's just starting. And so there weren't the influence of the scores. And today we don't bother. I mean, we don't really have a lot of interest in 100-point score stuff and all that kind of thing. So it's just not what we do. But at the time, it was a big deal for us and kind of put us on the map. And then, you know, from the very beginning, we've sold out of every bottle of every vintage we've made forever. And so that's the, you know, that cult part of it, quote unquote. You know, now there's a sort of, I don't know what the definition of a cult wine is anymore, but we were the first.
Without a doubt.
If not one of the first, we were, you know, if not the first, we were definitely one of the first, and people started lining up to buy our wine in the 80s, and so that, you know, that's been something that we've enjoyed and cherished since then, and really tried to, you know, always deliver on that consumer experience in the moment that somebody's enjoying one of our bottles of wine?
So a couple of things. One is that I did a happy dance in my head when you said your dad didn't grow up on Petrus and Michelin and Margaux, and there's been zero influence of the old world. I think it's really notable because a lot of brands, large and small, start with the premise that the old world is where it's at, and whether consciously and subconsciously there's this desire to emulate something that resembles it. Your dad and Justin deliberately went, and it's a foundational piece in my mind, that they went in the direction of American wine, used mm-hmm. American oak. Everything was subject to that mentality. How did it come about? Why was it such a powerful force that drove the brand initially?
Well, I think we were inspired. Including us, are influenced by the old world. As a matter of fact, the tower that's the drawing of our label. That's the original drawing of our label.
Beautiful.
The tower on our label is a Napa, a Napa classic image that was inspired by Chateau Latour, right? Because Chateau Latour only made one wine. They only made Cabernet. Oh. So Justin was somewhat inspired by that. I mean, that it's sort of where the idea came from. So there was, but where that example ends is in terms of we weren't trying to emulate from a wine style standpoint, right. Trying to grow wine as I'm doing air quotes, as good as Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. We were trying to make our Northern California interpretation, and I say Northern California because we didn't actually make our first Napa bottling until 1979. All of our bottle in those days said North Coast on it because there wasn't the kind of Napa focus that there mm-hmm. is today, and then Justin was influential in establishing the Alexander Valley AVA too. So mm-hmm. we started most of our fruit coming from the Alexander Valley, and then in 1979 we began to make the Alexander Valley and the Napa bottling. And so I think what they were, what Justin from a winemaking standpoint did that was different in those days was that the wines that were being produced in Napa and Sonoma in the early 70s, well, from the 50s, through the 70s, were very big tannic, low alcohol, mm-hmm. picked early, hard to drink when you release the wine. Mm-hmm. And so people would say, well, you got to, like a French wine, you got to lay these down for 10 or 15 years and then they'll be fine. Well, that mm-hmm. that didn't satisfy Justin's desire for what he was going to drink with dinner tonight. And so from a winemaking standpoint, the way he overcame that was the wine spends 2 years in our American oak barrels and then almost 2 years in bottle before we release it. So we just 2 months ago we released our 2014 Napa Valley in 2019, so it's in the fifth year after vintage still today. Mm-hmm. And so we're in barrel for 2 years and then in bottle for 20 months in the case of the Napa, so that wine's drinkable when we release it. We say drinkable upon release, and I think that was something that people just weren't used to, when to have a more approachable bottle of wine because we'd already aged it. And that was very appealing. And I think even today, now that's become our house style and is something that we stick to in terms of what we're trying to achieve with Silver Oak. And ultimately, it just tastes good. It doesn't need to be complicated and stuffy or to say, well, it will taste good in 10 years, but you have to wait. The wines that we release, we're very proud of and always are Silver Oak. They also have the added benefit that they do lay down and cellar really beautifully, and we keep a deep library available to always have past vintages, and of course our collectors have a lot of bottles in their cellars, and so those bottles today, even from the 80s, are still drinking just beautifully.
I truly marvel at the vision that your dad and Justin clearly shared in terms of the drinkability of the wine. When you mentioned that you hold the wine back a significant amount of time, several years, obviously economically speaking, as economic reality, particularly for a young brand at the time, that hasn't had the market testing yet. And given that we know that your dad was a very astute business person, on paper it didn't make sense. However, what it speaks to is the fact that they really acutely thought of the end user, about the consumer, and what it's like to be on that side. And to me, that's one of the core values of Silver Oak. My first experience, I'll get personal for just a second, was with 1977 Alexander Valley. And that made me move states. I came here in the very, you know, there's, everybody has a story about the bottle that turned their head. In my case, it happens to be yours.
I call it your epiphany wine.
Yes. and it made me, you know, really changed my work because I moved and I started in the wine industry and all that. But the other momentous occasion, at the time I didn't realize just how important it would become for me, is when I stood in line in Alexander Valley on the morning of your releases. And I wanted to get some large formats, and that's how you do it. And I went to Alexander Valley because the lines were shorter, typically. That was in the 90s. And I believe it was Justin that was bringing donuts to us while we were in line.
Oh, yeah, that was we still have that tradition.
that absolutely blew my mind. The level of loyalty that it builds, when a principal of, at the time, already extremely successful business, takes the time and the trouble to greet the consumers, to joke with them, it was just extraordinary. And now the hospitality aspect of the wine industry improved exponentially, but you were the first to really show that kind of largesse and authenticity. In other words, this is being used for marketing, but you were authentic from day one. And that's a personal thing for me because I'm not speaking from reading. I was there.
Right. That's neat.
So tell me about that.
Well, you know, I mean, Justin was a Christian brother.
Yeah.
And was at the Christian Brothers Winery and then was at UC Davis, and he met Bonnie Meyer, who ended up becoming his wife. And so he left the order. But I always think, you know, he always remained, you know, profoundly Catholic man. And I think he was, you know, in his heart, and this is certainly true for my father too, and who also was Catholic, you know, and it's not that necessarily, I mean, it just is what it is. And so, but, you know, in their heart, they were always concerned about the welfare of others, and which is, you know, something in the Christian tradition. And
absolutely.
And so I think that, it was very authentic, and I think Ray and Justin really shared that passion. And it's something then that today, especially as I came out to take over, you know, I wasn't here to make my mark or try and, you know, make it, try and fix something, because Silver Oak was already something that was very important to so many people.
Of course.
So, you know, my attitude's always been more, and with my brother Tim, a little more, you know, don't mess it up. Like, keep it what it is. You know, we can make incremental changes, and of course, like with our hospitality or having a winery chef, or, you know, we don't do Safeway store bought donuts anymore. For at least today, we have the guy out here, you know, cooking the donuts. So
wow, that's but, I'm gonna have
you know,
to.
But we carry on. We had Krispy Kreme for a while, but we don't do that anymore either. But it was, you know, so that always that. Evolution of the brand and kind of do always that. Justin had and Ray had a wonderful saying too that really informs us. We say it all the time around here that we have yet to make our best bottle of wine.
That's
and
great.
So for everything that we do, we're always thinking about how can we do it better, how can we do it, you know, less expensively, but to always improve quality, you know, how our fruit supply, and then, you know, in the last 20 years, we've also been really looking at like sustainability. So how can we, you know, be a better steward of the land and still produce a product that, you know, creates a bottle story like you just told, that, you know, somebody can have an epiphany that changes their life. I mean, that is what we try and do with wine. You know, maybe not every bottle, but it happens a lot.
I am sure that there's many, many stories out there. In fact, I know you even had a blog for a while that allowed that space for people to talk about their epiphanies. And it must be very gratifying to hear how your wine is such an active participant.
Yeah, it's amazing.
In people's lives.
Yeah, we could spend the entire time with me telling you bottle stories, but some of them are heartbreaking, some of them are fantastic, some of them are so rich. But it is something that we call ourselves the whole bunch. We all appreciate, and we get to hear these stories all the time. And you know, that is something that we realize that we're not trying to make a bottle that, you know, like I kind of alluded to before, that gets a score or is better. You know, this idea that our wine's better than the guy down the street, you know, is all nonsensical. It's really about our customer's experience with the bottle in the moment, and generally they're drinking it at some celebration or remembrance of somebody's life or what, you know, whatever. It's usually an occasion, and so it's not. I do know people who drink Silver Oak as their everyday wine, but for most people, that's not the case. Yeah. And so, I think that's something that is really special, and that we value, you know, from what our goal is, which is around all those individual experiences collectively. You know, it's kind of a neat thing.
You know, I cannot emphasize it enough that your brand's foundation is such a simple truth: take care of people. You've never been subject to trends. You've just very beautifully articulated how you stayed true to the course that was set. And it's so refreshing to hear that, because in this world, not just the wine world, we're all subject to trends, and people seem to flip-flop quite a bit on various issues. And certainly that's been anathema in the wine world, you know, all kinds of iterations, low alcohol, high alcohol, you know, what's popular, closures. I mean, it's all over the map. It's very confusing to the consumer. As a consumer, I find myself overwhelmed, and I've been in the industry for a couple of decades, so I should be better equipped, and yet that's not the case. So as I sit here now, I find it so heartwarming to hear someone that has created so much value over the years, on the consumer, but also on the trade side, on the business side. You employ a lot of people. You created a lot of jobs that maintained that philosophy and never deviated from that. That's quite admirable.
We try. We're not perfect at it, but no, we sure try. And I think because we are a family-owned business and a family-run business, you know, another thing we say around here is family first, because, you know, if an employee has an issue or, you know, a life thing or whatever, we try as best we can to try and help that situation. And, you know, and then at the same time, we also have to be professional. And if people struggle or aren't, you know, doing their part or whatever, then sometimes it's best to part ways. And mm-hmm. I saw a presentation by Alan Mulally, who was the CEO of Boeing, and then he was the guy who went in and fixed Ford in the recession. And so he had a wonderful way about saying, you know, that you can sort of love them and let them go. And, you know, you got to love them first.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.